Hello, I'm Joseph Oduo, Executive Program Director, Change and Transformation at the Department of Health, and also privileged to be a board member at IPA Victoria. I am also Vice Chair of the Victorian Executive at the Australian Computer Society, the ACS, which is the peak body for the ICT sector in this country with more than 47,000 members. Firstly, before we begin, I would also like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, and I pay respects to elders, past, present, and emerging. I recognize their continued connection to the land and waters of this beautiful place, and acknowledge they never ceded sovereignty. I extend that respect to my own community, all traditional owners of the lands, and any First Nations people who may listen to this recording. I had the privilege of hosting IPA Victoria's AI and the Future of Governance event on Wednesday, the 25th of October at Deloitte. Deloitte were our event partners on that day. Over 150 professionals across the public purpose sector attended the informative and interactive event and heard from an exceptional lineup of experts who delved into the emerging risks and opportunities that AI represents. The speakers included Professor Edward Hovey, Executive Director at Melbourne Connect, the University of Melbourne, Daniel Quinn, General Manager, Enabling Technologies Branch at the Department of Industry, Science and Resources of the Federal Australian Government, Chrissy Hornby, Chair of the Risk Community of Practice at IPA Victoria and an Associate Director at Grosvenor, Pete Williams, the Chief Edge Officer at Deloitte Australia. This episode focuses on the audience's unanswered questions, and it is my pleasure to interview Professor Edward Hovey once again, who will share his insights, reflections, and wise words about all things AI.
Hello, Joseph. Thank you for inviting me. I had such a wonderful time when we had the day there with 150 professionals. It's great to be able to explore some of the topics in a little more detail. So I'm looking forward to this discussion.
Thank you, Professor. To begin, for those who did not attend the AI and Future of Governance event, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
Yeah, I'm a computer scientist, and I've been interested in AI since I did my PhD in 1987 at Yale University in the States. All my career was in the States, mostly looking at machine learning, natural language processing, and something we called then digital government. I helped start the Digital Government Society in the United States in the early 2000s. I was the second president of the association, and we helped set up an association also in Europe, in EU. So I've had an interest always in seeing how you can take AI and make its inventions relevant to the public, not only to the industrial sector, of course, but also to government, because that's such an important part of life. And AI has so much to offer if it's done properly. That's the frustrating bit, if it's done properly.
Well, one of the frustrations we had on the day of the event, there were so many exciting questions from the audience, which sparked this discussion that we're having today. Our very first question is on AI and conscious sentient beings. AI may not become conscious sentient beings, but there are lots of fears that it will easily displace hundreds of thousands of jobs across sectors. What are your views on whether this will occur? What level of social disruption we expect to see, and how AI will improve productivity?
I have to smile, Joseph, at this question, because so many people ask me two questions. Number one, is this thing going to eat my job? And number two, is it going to take over humanity and is it going to control us? And that those two questions reflect a misunderstanding of what AI is, actually. So just like motor cars, which are a complicated thing, and if I ask you exactly how does your motor car work, I'm not sure you can tell me in all details, but it does what it does, and you know how what it can do and how you know how to control it, right? You have to have a driver's license. You have to learn. There are mechanics who know how to fix it. When a thing goes crazy, you know there's laws about how this. AI is no different. AI is just a technology where there are a bunch of mechanics called AI engineers who know how to fix it. There are certain behaviors it can do. It can do more than a motor car can do, and we don't quite know today, for this new style of AI called generative AI, we don't quite know today all the different things it can do. We know that it can learn, so it can expand its behavior. But there are also some things we know it cannot do. Just like your motor car cannot fly to the moon, AI today has no consciousness. There is nothing in there that has a soul or a mind or a self or a goal. The generative AI that we talk about today has two parts. It's sort of a pattern matcher, which matches your prompt against its memory of everything it's read, and it pulls out little fragments that match, just like Google does. But instead of giving you a document, it takes the little fragments and joins them together and makes sentences and continues just to speak the sentences from left to right, just like my 9-year-old daughter who doesn't know when to stop. So there's no consciousness in this machine. When it says, I think or I want, it's just pulling out those little phrases which it has read on the web and stringing them together. There is nothing more. So the first question, is AI going to take over the universe and is it going to control us and so on? Not today's AI, I'm very sorry. It simply cannot. Now, some people say, well, what about all these famous AI people who warn you and tell you about the fears and so on? Even Elon Musk, who's not an AI person, doesn't know what he's talking about. That's simply not true. They get a lot of press from being alarmist, but it is simply not true that there is anything in the AI machine which has its own goals, its own personality, its own desires. Not today's AI, maybe 100 years from now, but not today's AI. Now we come to the second question. Is this thing going to eat my job? Well, that's an interesting question. A horse taxi driver in London in 1800s would have said, is this motor car going to eat my job? And you have to say, I'm sorry, yes, the motor car is going to eat your job, but you are not out of a job. Instead of riding a horse in the weather and the snow and the ice, you're now sitting inside a car with a heater and you're driving the taxi. You have to repurpose yourself. You have to learn how to use the new technology. But the new technology still needs an owner and a controller and a driver. The new AI is no different. It still needs a prompt maker and somebody who knows how to read what it says and how to carry out the information into the outside world, how to make the reports, how to send them, how to interpret what it's doing. It's just an accelerator. Your car can go faster than the horse carriage. The AI machine can go faster than just you plus Google, right? It can write the report for you as opposed to you getting Google and doing. That's the acceleration we see. So we are going to see, as you asked, a lot of acceleration in certain kinds of jobs, especially text-oriented jobs like report writing and summarization, and especially image-oriented jobs like creating posters, creating advertisements and things like that. There we're going to see a lot of acceleration. When it comes to nursing, anything where you need a human warmth, a body, a hug, we're not going to see any change. AI is just not going to go there because it can't.
So no consciousness in the machine. And in your opinion, what are the key policy issues that we need to be conscious to regarding implementation of AI technologies?
Now, that's a very important question because unfortunately, as you know, every new technology that has been introduced by humanity has had sometimes catastrophic results. When people started domesticating fire, things burned. When people made airplanes, airplanes crashed. When people made cars, cars went over people, right? When people made nuclear reactions, when people made electricity, always any new technology has some cost. Any wise government is going to try to make regulations and guidance early on to say, let's limit the cost, let's limit even the potential of any kind of damage. So if we look at the world today, now that generative AI has become so big in the recent times, as usual, the United States government is sort of sitting back and just listening, 2 weeks ago, President Biden issued an announcement, a White House executive order, that said to all the different stakeholders in AI, you shall sit down and look in your area and make suggestions about the policies we need to control healthcare, to control transportation, to control education, to control science. So the Americans are taking a very slow, measured approach. As usual, the Europeans have already made regulations controlling generative AI before they even know what it is. So their regulations just say, no, 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 thou shalt not. Though they're stifling all innovation and they're stifling much use, that's not to the benefit of Europe. Interestingly, Australia is doing a middle path. About 5 months ago, the Australian government issued two and then later one more requests for sort of information or guidance about how to create regulations. One was general, one was aimed at education and sent to universities particularly, and one was about industry and asking about regulating industry and commerce. I was on two panels from the university that helped made recommendations. For the education one, they received over 50 submissions from the whole country, and there are websites where you can go to and find what people across the whole country say. What should we do? What are the concerns that we have in education or in industry? It turns out that when you say, how can I control this thing, this mysterious thing called generative AI, because it's so flexible, it's not so easy to make rules to say you have to stay in the road, you have to go on the left-hand side of the road, etc. Because AI keeps growing and changing. We don't know where the inventiveness of usage of people is going to lead us. So the best you can say is, you must act ethically. You must make sure that your AI does not do any hurt. You must act without bias. You must make sure that your AI, when it is trained in such a way that it takes equal recognition of everybody, of all kinds of people, rich and poor, etc. Right? There are certain basic principles that we now recommended to to government to say, these things, these basic principles of decent human behavior and decent machine or machine plus human behavior, we have to enshrine. We have to make clear that they're clearly stated. The second step is, when you have these principles, now you must say to the AI builder, okay, Mr. or Miss AI builder, when you're making an AI, I want you to make sure you've done your homework. You cannot take a data set that was not checked for bias. You cannot take an algorithm that was not checked for maybe going off the rails and doing something wrong. For instance, if you build a self-driving car, you must check that no hacker can sit at the side of the road and hack into your car and drive the car into his garage, right? You have to put that security in. So you, Mr. and Ms. AI builder, there are certain good practice guidelines that computer science has developed over the past 60 years that have been collected by a body called the International Standards Organization, ISO. And inside the ISO family, there are about 25 guidelines governing AI already. They're already there. They've already been made. You, Mr. and Ms. AI builder, you have to look at those guidelines and you have to listen to them and you have to obey them. So when you make your product, which is going to help a doctor diagnose your medicine, which is going to help a car drive automatically, which is going to help you write your reports or do your regulation compliance testing or something, you must make sure you have done your homework with respect to those best practices. And then when we've done that, now you can go ahead and build your machine and make it available. You can try to sell it. You can try to deploy it. You can try to use it in government, etc. But you've done your homework and you've pointed the history of your machine back into its roots, into the data, into the algorithms, into the experts, etc. So if something does go wrong, we know where to go fix. So that's the middle ground that Australia has taken. It's not like saying, oh, we don't know, just tell us. And it's not saying, no, no, no. It's saying, let's do it responsibly, carefully, with due diligence and control, so that we know where we're going. And should anything go wrong, we know where to go fix it. I think that's a very wise approach.
Thank you for that. And I note that we'll have in the show notes some of the information around the executive order that President Biden signed last week, and show notes as well to include the Bletchley Park Declaration, which 27 countries across the world signed up to. I think the broad theme across all of those declarations and national announcements was safety, human centricity, trustworthiness, and responsibility. The question then becomes for national governments such as ours, in the quality aspect of maximizing the use of AI in the public sector. Do you think that when the public sector organizations and for-purpose organizations think about the data management of this, what are the key considerations that they need to take into account? So if you're a senior manager or executive in the public sector or in the for-purpose sector, you're thinking about data, what are your top considerations there?
That's a good question. I think there are two considerations. One is the traditional one, because in government, you have access to privileged access to data, to privacy, to information that people don't share with anyone, but they will share with you because you're government. You have an extra responsibility to be super careful. That does not go away. That actually becomes stronger now in the world of AI and generative AI, because when you entrust the data to an AI system, when you upload your prompt, when you upload your data into an AI system, you don't know where it's going. Now, OpenAI, the company who made ChatGPT, and Google and Microsoft and Tencent and the other companies who are now all of them building these generative AI systems, they will promise with hand over heart, oh, we will never look at your data. We will never do anything. And you know, I lived for 25 years in America. I don't trust them one bit. I simply don't trust. I have a Facebook page, which I never look at. I have a Twitter account, which I never look at. I have a LinkedIn, which I may look at occasionally. I simply don't trust those big companies. I'm sorry, right? It's just me. So if I were a government, I would absolutely not trust those companies to keep my privileged, specially granted information from the public private. No, simply no. Does that mean I cannot use AI? No, it doesn't mean that. It means that I have to create my own sort of ring-fenced AI-enabled service that is for which there's an air gap around, where there's no connection up into OpenAI or into Google or Microsoft. Now, of course, the big companies hate this. They want to be the center of the universe to control all information. But shortly after, let me say it this way, when OpenAI announced ChatGPT on November 1st last year, for about 3 months, there was panic in the AI world because people thought, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? We can't build this machine. It took them 4.5 years, $100 million on special purpose computers to build this big thing. There's no way. And then Google came 2 months later and they built their thing, and Microsoft for $10 billion bought OpenAI thing, and it looked like there would only be three in the universe. But people like me, my colleagues, my friends in all over the world, of course say, can we build a small one? Can we build one just for like our university? Can we build one just for the Australian government? Can we build one for the Victorian government? Can we build one for a little company? Can we build one for me? And the question is very interesting. And the evidence is, if you've looked what's happened over the last 4 or 5 months, the answer is yes, 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 and yes. So you can now download a starter model called Llama 2, which Meta, which used to be Facebook, built, which they put on the web, which doesn't have links to anything else. You can download that. And on top of that, you can put your own information and you can build your own chat machine. And that doesn't have to be connected to anybody. And it doesn't even need fancy purpose computers. It just needs enough computers to run. So at this university, for instance, where I am now, we already have two such versions, both based on Llama. And on top of it, we're building university information, like what are all the courses? What are the rules for students to graduate? What do students need to know about their insurance? What do employees, staff of the university need to know about their superannuation, etc.? We just put that on top and we can query it inside the university for our needs. Nothing stops a government from saying, okay, I'm going to take Llama 2, or I'm going to take what's called Open Crawl, or I'm going to take Wikipedia, and I'm going to build my own specific purpose generative AI model to actually, and I'm going to put my own government things, whether it's water or regulation of banking or whatever, I'm going to put my own sets of rules and information in there as much as I want to. I could put my HR information. I can put anything I want to there, but it's mine. It doesn't go outside anywhere. The benefits are you get the privacy and security. The costs are you need an expert. Still today, you need an expert to build that thing, and you don't know how good it is. We know that these generative AI models hallucinate. That's the famous word people say. Why? Because they take a little piece of a fragment of a sentence, you give them the prompt, they match that prompt into their big knowledge, and they pull out some fragment of sentence and another bit, they glue two of them together. They say, oh, now I've got a longer thing. Let me find more fragments. They glue that together. There's no proof that when you glue three fragments together, even if each fragment is true, that the total sentence is true too. Right? It could just imagine all kind of crazy things, and it does. So when you build your own AI model on limited data, the fragmentation problem and the hallucination problem becomes stronger. So now you say, okay, in the interest of privacy, I, as government, I'm going to get someone to build me my own AI model, and increasingly that becomes cheaper. OpenAI 3 days ago announced that they will allow people to build their own things on top of ChatGPT, right? You're still beholden to OpenAI because they desperately don't want to lose the market. I say, goodbye, OpenAI. Forget OpenAI. We'll build it on top of things that people make available. OpenAI is not open despite their name. So let's say we wait 6 months and then we say, okay, let's take our own starter model, Llama 2 or something, and we pay somebody, and in 3 months, we have our own machine with our own data. We say what we want on top of it. Now, the second step is we have to educate our workers, our staff, how to check for hallucination, how to check for completeness. That's now our job, right? That's why we cannot throw away the horse rider and say, no, we don't need a driver anymore. We need that government expert who knows the domain deeply, who can look what this machine has given and say, that's a beautiful summary. That would have taken me 2 days to write. You did it in 2 minutes. Thank you, AI machine. But let me just check that you didn't miss something and you didn't make mistakes. And you just weed out the hallucinations, you do the re-editing, and then you can do your work faster, much more quickly and easily, much more fun, much less of that sort of grunt work. But you are still absolutely needed to do the checking.
Thank you for that response. And I note OpenAI's release of enterprise generative AI capability, which allows organizations to build custom versions of their ChatGPT for their organizations, with some of the benefits that you've spoken about, which include security and privacy. And of course, some of those limitations that need to be taken into account, which include whether you'll allow your organization's data to be used for training their open AI models. So is air-gapped truly air-gapped? I suppose that then leads to my next question, which is about forgetting something that is no longer correct. And you've spoken about hallucinations. How do you perceive that this will work out in the future? So you've spoken about editing, but I'm speaking about a situation where an internal policy platform becomes superseded by something outside the organization.
That's something that I don't think anybody today can answer. There is quite a lot of research on how you can make these things forget what they know. Now, the human mind is an amazing machine, because if I tell you that in a few months' time, Donald Trump is the president again of the United States, God forbid, but let's say that happens, you will know, oh, Joe Biden was the president, but he is no longer the president, right? So your mind can do an update and you have that fact and you proceed perfectly. These AI models don't have a sense of time. They don't have a self, as I said. There's no consciousness. They just have all these facts stored in sort of a disparate cloud. So if you say Joe Biden is president, and now you say Joe Biden is not president, both those facts exist inside its memory, and they get matched whenever they get matched, and they produce sentences whenever they produce sentences. So if you want this machine now to say, I don't want Joe Biden to be president. In fact, I want to take a fact out that I had in there, some embarrassing fact about myself. I want that not to be there anymore. I want to expunge it altogether. Nobody knows how to do that. We don't know how to trace where an individual fact disappears into this network. So it's sort of, I don't know, it's a disquieting thing. On the one hand, when the New York Times and book authors come and they go up against these generative AI companies, they say, you have stolen my content. You've eaten my book and it's in there and blah, blah, blah. And you say, well, excuse me, we did read your book, but please show me where is your book in this machine. Show me any 6-word sequence that you wrote that's in this machine. They cannot do it. Because the information is not stored as little phrases in a long, long, long spreadsheet. It's dissipated in some indirect ways, some technical things, which is so disparate and so abstracted that you cannot recognize any particular words anymore in these big neural networks. So now you say, well, how can I find that embarrassing fact about myself that I want to delete? And the answer is, today, we don't know. We don't know how to do it. So there's a lot of research in research space trying to say, well, can I do something like get facts out and then run them against my delete list or my change list so that I can say, well, before you say anything, just let me see if there's stuff in there that I don't want to say that I want to delete. And you can run that for many things like bias and ethics, not just facts you want to delete, but things you don't want to say or things that you have to hedge carefully depending on the audience. So that's actually a very active area of research to do this. A colleague of mine wants to build a machine that can take something like a generative AI knowledge store and put it in a different form where you can actually delete it. And the problem there is you have hundreds of millions or tens of billions of pieces of information. You need a very big knowledge store and you need to find the thing you want to delete and take it out. That's not a trivial operation. That's a very, very difficult technical operation to make it work efficiently and stuff. That's what he's an expert in. So I wish him Godspeed. I hope he can do that, because then you can say, I have my big AI model. I put it into his machine. I do my editing and deleting, and I push it back into the AI model. And now I've got a cleaned up version, and I know exactly what I'm allowed to I can sort of control. And I can update every night or every week or something. That doesn't exist today. So we don't have the capability today to do what you asked. I'm sorry. I wish we did, and we're working on it.
Thank you. Thank you for that response. My next question is about governance. And the topic of our event on the 25th of October was all about AI and the future of governance. How will AI reshape the experience of governance from a board and a board member perspective?
That's a very interesting question, too. I don't quite know how to think about that. So you must excuse me. I have to draw back on my own experience for when I was president of various associations and things like this. And the experience I had from governance is you need the facts. You need to know whom to speak to and when things go wrong, how to sort of make a policy for addressing when things go wrong or when you have something new, how to make a policy. But then you need the people. In my understanding, governance is all to do with people and how you inspire, mobilize, define what you need to do. That's not generative AI. As I said again, There is no soul in this machine. There is no knowledge, no goals. It doesn't know. It's your assistant who has read a lot, but is actually fairly stupid, cannot find logical gaps and cannot find problems. It's just read a lot and it'll tell you what it's read. And it can write well, but it's not necessarily true what it's writing. It doesn't know. So when you come to governance and you're sitting on a board or you're the chairman, the chair or the president or something, I think more than ever, you have to tell everybody working in your organization, use this machine, try, just keep trying, try anything you can to see if you can accelerate the quality and the speed and the happiness of your work, but don't trust it one bit. Always check. And when we come back and we join and we do the governance of our enterprises, our government, we actually do the structuring of our procedures, then we have to be grateful that we have this machine that can give us more information more completely, more quickly, more well written, but it doesn't take away from us any responsibility about driving and executing proper governance. Again, we come back to the thing, this thing is not eating my job. It's just making my job easier. And I think when it comes to governance, it's probably not changing my job very much. Probably not.
So I suppose then a little question following all that would be, as I reflect on your response, the same way we have ESG reporting to cover the environment, social issues, governance, and we can see the way cybersecurity has become relevant on the governance agenda. So from your response, we should expect AI to become as relevant or even more relevant on the agenda?
AI must become relevant, absolutely. So in that sense, I should have said that earlier. We need a specific aspect of the governance in government to look and monitor what's happening in AI. And whenever somebody comes and says something that I'm now doing, I'm a doctor and I'm diagnosing cancer and I'm using this machine to diagnose tumors to say if they're cancerous or not. AI was able to do that better than doctors even 10, 12 years ago. Or I'm a regulator and I want to make sure that this particular bank in their internal procedures is adhering to the regulations that I have created. They have thousands of regulations, or I have created thousands, and they have hundreds or thousands of internal policies and procedures. How on earth am I going to do that? There was older AI to do the sort of alignment to say, here's my rules, show me their procedures that actually align, let me read and make and convince myself. AI is going to help with that, but I must make sure I can trust my AI. So when a company, when a society, when people come and they say, I'm using AI to do all these wonderful things, whether it's commercial or anyone else, I have to say, did you check your AI properly? Is it ethical? Is it biased? Does it introduce harm that you're not checking for? And so I think the additional scrutiny that AI demands from government is to say, when you use AI, make sure when you produce AI, make sure you've done it with due diligence, as I was saying before. And when you use AI, make sure that you have actually checked and confirmed with your human insight that it is correct. If you have not done those two things, I'm going to be very unhappy. And then we need to have some kind of rules or fine or laws or something to say, if you don't use AI properly, you should not be allowed to use AI. If you don't have a driver's license, you cannot drive. It's that simply. You cannot drive an AI machine if you haven't got a driver's license for an AI, for your particular kind of AI. What exactly the shape of those licenses are, we don't know. And that's what we have to work on together. And we need a very good partnership between society and government, a very agile, flexible, ongoing discussion for a society person to say, I've got a self-driving car. I've got a machine that can diagnose cancer. I've got a thing that can teach children, and so on. And government people say, oh, really? Well, I know that this is an issue. And I know that now that you're doing this, still the principles apply. We want to keep people safe and protected and happy, and you know, society must go well. So how does your new thing fit into this picture? You tell me, and you tell me where the dangers are, and I will then develop procedures to monitor this and to govern all this. That dialogue is not something you do in 2 weeks. Government has a history of being sort of lagging development. And in this case, we have to actually move a little faster because AI is moving so fast. But there's a good thing in that we have dialogues like this. You and I come from two different sectors, right? The research sector and the government sector. We're talking now. I don't know if 50 years ago that would have happened so quickly. I think we need to foster this dialogue as at all levels, and we need to have much more interaction and much more quick responsive, I don't want to say experimentation, but responses that we more pliable, that we can see that we jointly develop our best practices.
And speaking of best practices, we'll have in the show notes the guidance from the Office of Management of Budget in the United States, which speaks about the implementation guidance for AI following Biden's executive order that he signed recently. My next question, I suppose, is all about the AI race, if you can think of it that way. I was very privileged to attend the PRC oration at Melbourne Connect recently, and the orator, Professor Michelle Simmons, was speaking about the race as far as quantum computing is concerned. Do you see this as a race? And if so, what are the consequences for Australia? Should we fall behind in understanding what the context of AI is and the potential for the public purpose sector?
I've wondered about this, actually. It's a very nuanced situation, because if you say things are black and white, yes, it's a race and stuff, then immediately you say, what's the winner and the loser and what's going to happen to the loser, etc. But in... And of course, there is a race aspect to this. Of course, the fact that three American companies have it and now two Chinese companies have it too, and that the whole world is busy building. I was talking to a colleague in Abu Dhabi 2 months ago, in Bulgaria, actually, and they've built one. I was talking to a colleague of his last week, and they just built another one there. As I said, here at University of Melbourne, we've built two, somebody in Vietnam. Somebody at Monash University told me his company in Vietnam, he's Vietnamese, has just built one too. These little things are popping up all over. I think that's very good in terms of the race metaphor. If there is a race, it's not going to be four big horses or five big horses running to the end and taking all the game. It's going to be lots and lots of little horses and little doggies and little whatever trying to do their own thing. And in that sense, the race is much less critical. It's not just all or nothing. There's a disaster or not a disaster. It's much more dissipated and much more robust. I can tell you a little anecdote from the early days of the internet, which is interesting. I worked at an institute where the person who was responsible for much of the organization of the internet, his name was John Postel. He looked like Dumbledore. He had long hair, a long beard, and sandals and things. They knew him as Mr. No. Because in the early days, when computers were being linked together, and you had a little computer in Boston and one in Los Angeles and one in Washington, some of my colleagues, they played a Haydn or a Beethoven trio. One was the piano in Boston, the violinist was in Los Angeles, and the cellist was in Washington. And the challenge was, can we play so that when you listen anywhere in the country, you hear the three instruments at the same time? Because the little information has to come all across the network, right? And it has to be assembled at the assembly point, that all three instruments have to be aligned together. So how do we organize this big network of computers, this internet, in such a way that the information can flow, and if any node goes down, it can find a different way to flow, that all the little packets can go? So when you send an email to your colleague, you think it's like one page. It actually goes up into, say, 15 or 20 or 30 little pieces, little packets. Each one has its address on top saying, I'm coming from Joseph, I'm going to somewhere else. And then these packets flow a lot different ways and they get assembled at the other end. If you send a packet from here to London, it can go through 20 different paths to get to London before it's assembled. So then there was a big discussion at the internet stage. Shall we have like a big post office node in the middle where everything is controlled, where this goes and there? Or shall we have three post office nodes? So we have seven post office nodes. And there was a lot of push, especially from European side, government side. Yes, we need some controlled, cyber secure post office nodes. And this Dr. No person, my colleague John Postel Dumbledore, said no. He was famous after 3 days of meetings just saying no. What we have today is a distributed system where there is no big post office node. There are a few nodes who have some address tables, but if any one of them goes down, the information flows a different way. You cannot take down the internet unless you are a major force like China, where you can cut a lot of links and just make it internal. So I think the same is happening with AI, with generative AI. If we have a lot of little generative AI systems all the way down to sort of almost individual sized, and they're running all over the place, even up in the cloud where I pay Telstra $25 a month to have my own little one, nobody can kill this. Nobody can take it down. And so as long as you're not afraid that it's going to take over the universe or something, this is a very good thing. It distributes that capability everywhere to all of us, right? So that means in the metaphor of a race, is there a race here? Yes, there's a race to develop new capabilities and new understandings and new methods of using it. And the more we succeed in the race, the more we can tell one another, the more we can benefit one another. I don't think it's a race in sense of you have some secret thing and you're going to outsmart me and you're going to, I don't think it works. Computer scientists don't work like that. The impetus was you say, I found something new, goodness, look, I publish, look how smart I am. And everybody else says, oh, you did that, I'm going to do the same thing and do better, look how smart I am. So that information flow through something like the internet exists very, very strongly in this AI community. So in that sense of a race of winners and losers, I think no. But I think in terms of a fast development and the trying to get somewhere first, yes, right? But not winners and losers.
This podcast follows IPA Victoria's AI and the Future of Governance event that was held in October 2023. The event is one offering within IPA Victoria's Future of Work series and strategic theme of connection through collaboration, new skills and celebration. To learn more about what IPA Victoria is doing in this place, please visit our website at vic.ipaa.org.au. You can stay in touch with what IPA Victoria does by following them on LinkedIn at IPAA Victoria or on Twitter, IPAAVIC. This program is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I am Joseph Oduo, and thanks for listening.